You're listening to KRUU FM, 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered radio, broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in sunny Fairfield. Our solar panels are heating up today.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a beautiful day, and I hope that if you're listening on Monday, which is a rebroadcast Monday morning, that it's also going to be a beautiful day.
And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn. And like she mentioned, we broadcast usually live Fridays at 1 p.m. and rebroadcast Monday mornings at 8 a.m. And the shows are also available on writersvoices.com after the fact.
Yes.
And do check out my website. We just redesigned it, and I'm really happy about it, so would love to have your comments.
Okay.
Today, so who do we have today, Mom?
Well, today we have most, you know, I know I say this every time, but this is a book you really have to read. You really do, because it affects all of us. And the name of it is Fracture, Essays, Poems, and Stories on Fracking in America. And if you haven't heard of fracking, you haven't been...
You haven't been living in America.
You haven't been paying attention. Okay. Taylor
Broerby
is an award-winning essayist and poet, a fellow at the Black Earth Institute. He is at work on both an essay and poetry collection and is also a reviews editor for Orion Magazine. And this book bears witness to hydraulic fracking, fracturing in the United States. Fracture, Essays, Poems, and Stories on Fracking in America, brings together the voices of more than 50 writers exploring the complexities of fracking and the negative results.
So we have essays, we have poems, we have stories in this book. So welcome to Writers' Voices, Taylor.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be with you today.
How did you get involved in this project?
Yeah, this project really stems from my home region. I'm originally from western North Dakota. I'm from coal country. My entire upbringing was actually supported by coal. And this is the part of the world where Iowans certainly have been hearing about it more and more. Western North Dakota is where the Bakken oil boom is happening. And in 2013, Deb Marquardt, who's another native North Dakotan, who teaches at Iowa State University, she and I were asked to be part of a grant by the North Dakota Humanities Council to travel around teaching creative writing workshops in 13 communities impacted by the Bakken oil boom. So in 3 weeks, we put on about 5,000 miles. And for both of us, that was our first time fully back in the boom. Which was just haunting and devastating and illuminating in many ways about this out of sight, out of mind sort of place. And after that, I spent the summer of 2014 living in western North Dakota, writing about fracking and interviewing residents in the state about what was happening to their lives, and decided to go to Iowa State actually to study with Deb to work on my books around fracking. This book happened to come into being just a month into graduate school. I had gone to a book release party for another anthology, Prairie Gold, which is published by Ice Cube Press, based in North Liberty, Iowa, just outside of Iowa City. And the publisher, Steve Semkin, and I just struck up a conversation. He asked me where I'd moved from, and I told him I just spent my summer living and writing in the Bakken oil boom. So we started talking about fracking. We both realized we each had a love for the great Minnesota writer Paul Grucco, whose writing is so lovely about the tall grass prairie. And we kept talking for about 20 minutes about fracking, its implications, and off the cuff, I just said, I'm so shocked no one has done an anthology of writing on fracking. And Steve said, well, that's a good idea. I mean, when a publisher says that's a good idea, you race home and you draw up a query letter, and I sent it to him the next day. That this looks great. Let's get a full book proposal. And a week later, we started working on this anthology, and I didn't really have a sense of who was going to be writing about it, because so many creative writing programs are focused, you know, on an individual's art. You know, you're not necessarily being forced to write about political issues, though you can. You're not forced to write about environmental issues, though you can. So we sent around an open call for submission to both creative writing programs and to environmental studies programs around the country. And I started soliciting some of the country's most revered environmental writers, and the incredible thing is these people would respond and say, yes, I would love to be a part of this project, I think partly because this book had not yet been created. You know, when someone like Bill McKibben says, yes, I'll contribute a piece, and you tell some of his buddies, hey, Bill's going to be in this book, they want to come to the party. So it just sort of grew out of that, a snowball effect, and we produced the book really in record time, basically within a year. We had gotten it assembled and ready to go to print.
Wow. And were all these pieces written specifically for the book?
There are a few pieces that appeared in print before that have been altered, but really it's probably less than 10% of the material in here. You know, there are a few people such as Richard Manning, his piece, it's a more extended version of what his Harper's article originally was, partly because when you're working in a tight space, your editor will say, well, we gotta trim it down. And so he was excited to actually be able to put out the full version of what he had written. But so much of it was new to this volume. And there were pieces that were getting placed before the book came out in more condensed versions to sort of help raise some awareness about the anthology coming out, like Kathleen Dean Moore, one of the great environmental philosophers in the country. Her piece, a condensed version of it, had appeared in High Country News in December, and then Patricia Nelson Limerick, one of the country's great historians, her piece just appeared a week after the book's publication in High Country News as well. So it sort of had this wonderful quality of helping people be aware that a book like this was starting to come into existence.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Taylor Brorby, and we're talking about the anthology that he edited entitled Fracture: Essays, Poems, and Stories on Fracking in America. And you had a co-editor as well. When did she? And she was the editor of the Prairie Gold anthology that you referred to earlier, correct?
Correct. Yep. Stephanie Brooktrout was in her final year of the A program at Iowa State University when I was in my first year. And Stephanie has just a wonderful editorial eye. I mean, she's just a wizard at catching grammatical errors or making wonderful suggestions for all of our writers as well. So it was wonderful in assembling this anthology, which when you see it, you know, it's nearly 500 pages. And that's not only a big book, but it would be a lot for one person to work on, especially when you're trying to get that book out into the world in a timely way. I mean, this is such a politically relevant conversation that we're having. I mean, just yesterday, the Iowa Utilities Board approved the very large Bakken pipeline that will now supposedly cut diagonally across the state. So we wanted to get a book out into the world that could be both illustrative and illuminating for readers, but also one that could get people's stories from around the country to let people know what not just residents in North Dakota and Oklahoma and Texas and Pennsylvania who live in fracking zones are experiencing, but also those places where we don't really hear about fracking. You know, the frac sand mining in northeast Iowa or southwest Wisconsin, now the Bakken pipeline that's slated to come through Iowa, places like Vernal, Utah, you know. But Steph was so good at not only keeping me on track, but also just helping me make selections and ordering the book. It's such a gift to have someone to bounce ideas off of, to say, how does this piece work, this poem? How does that work next to this essay? And would that be a nice flow for a reader? So it was such a wonderful, seamless project and really a great honor to work with Steph on this anthology.
Well, Taylor, you said you started this right at the beginning of your master's program?
Yeah, that's correct.
So
yeah.
How did you do both at the same time?
Four.
How were you able to do both at the same time?
I don't sleep much.
I'll bet.
Part of it is, you know, I don't know. I'm one of those writers who you know, not only takes writing seriously, but I also do find it's a great joy. I mean, so often writers talk about how slow they are, how difficult the work is, and things like that, and I get that, and I want to empathize with all of my writing colleagues. I also am one of those people, I don't really like hard work that I go, well, if writing hard, I could go and sell insurance. You know what I mean? Like, I'd make a lot more money. It could be easier to do on some level. But to me, I don't mean to diminish writing, because writing isn't easy. But what I mean to say is I get a lot of joy out of it, partly because I get to live in stories. I get to wake up in the morning. I usually get up around 5 a.m. and, you know, start writing between 5 and 8 a.m. because I want to give my first best energy to my writing. And then I, you know, the rest of the day can get basically the tired version of so part of it is that sense of purpose that I really feel in an anthology like this, that a book like this did not exist. And part of it, the writing in a graduate program is really wonderful. It's a good time to focus in on your writing. But I, you know, I entered this master's program a little bit later than some of my colleagues. You know, I was 27 going into it, so I knew what I wanted to be working on. I'll be having a poetry collection coming out next year, just before I graduate from the program. Because I wanted to be working on projects that I knew not only I could complete, but I didn't want to spend my time writing pieces that felt disparate and leave a program without a book. And this project really helped anchor me in the program to say, what does it mean to be part of the writing world, the writing community, to really be practicing your craft in a real editorial way as you're going into the writing life, I guess.
Now, Taylor, when I looked at your bio, it seemed like you had already had a lot of success as a writer and a teacher of writing before you entered this program. What made you decide to pursue the master's, and why this particular one? You're at Iowa State University. It's a master's in creative writing and environment. Is that correct? Yeah.
Yeah, it's only one of two programs with that particular focus in the country. The other one is Chatham University out in Pittsburgh, where Cheryl St. Germain teaches, who used to teach at the Iowa State creative writing program. And I had gotten into other creative writing programs, and, you know, it's so hard to qualify what's a prestigious writing program. Is it the faculty? Is it the funding? Is it just the name recognition? And I had gotten into programs we would say are quote-unquote, have a better reputation than Iowa State University. But to me, so few master's programs give you the amount of time that Iowa State gives you. It's a three-year master's program, which means by the end of your third year, you should or be nearly at the point to have a publishable book. I mean, 3 years in a program that's giving you a very good amount of funding. I mean, Iowa State gives a very wonderful amount of funding as far as these types of programs go. And to me, that focus on environment is so important. I mean, for me, who the predictions about climate change or what we're facing with topsoil erosion, the predictions that we're hearing in the news are not abstractions to me, partly because that is the world I will be living in. You know, much of my writing focuses on environment, on climate change, on these types of issues. And so many of these meetings that I go to or conferences, there are a lot of gray-haired people there, which is fine. I need some wisdom. Mm-hmm. I need elders there. Part of that, though, how we talk about this, for many people, it's in the future, which means they're, you know, they might be exiting the planet in 15 to 20 years, but I still have 50 good years on this planet. And so I really came into this program with a sense of purpose with this MFA. I have a previous master's from Hamline University up in St. Paul, and so I had already been thinking, what are those books I want to be working on? I think sometimes MFAs get a bad rap of, oh, just go here and work on your writing and that'll be fine. And I waited a little while to go and get my MFA, which is considered a terminal degree, because I really wanted to wait until I knew what I wanted to write about, and then I could have that community help support that. So really, in this program, I've just been so fortunate with the amount of work that's been accepted. A chapbook of poems is out by me. This anthology is now out. Next year, a poetry collection will be coming out as well. And then I will be starting to send out my first essay collection by the end of my program. Partly, I think, is because I knew I had something to say, and that sort of helps keep me at that writing desk day after day.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Taylor Brorby. He's the editor and also has an essay in Fracture, Essays, Poems, and Stories on Fracking in America. You know, Taylor, when I first, and this is published by Ice Cube Press, we've had, quite a few Ice Cube Press authors on the show over the years, including Steve Semkin, who is both the publisher and an author. And we did have, I believe, Stephanie was here with Prairie Gold. I know we interviewed a couple of the editors on Prairie Gold. Another person from the Iowa State Creative Writing and Environment Program that we interviewed in the past was Xavier Cavazos.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Diamond Grove Slave Tree, which I think was also Ice Cube Press. So, you know, it's that program is definitely building momentum in getting published authors, you know, in the students becoming published authors. That's great.
It's been a very wonderful place to be, to sort of have this continuing narrative in the program of you're not only there to work on your writing, but you're also there to really become a practitioner of that art form. And the Iowa State University program has such a strong connection with Ice Cube Press. Many students in the program do internships with Steve, you know, to build some editorial experience and to see what is it like to work for a small independent press, and to see how, you know, really he's a one-man show. He designed our book cover. He's out doing publicity. You know, he's reaching out to different bookstores and institutions to schedule events. And Steve, I mean, when other presses have been sort of falling by the wayside, it seems to be that Ice Cube Press is just, you know, sailing through in such a beautiful way and producing books that I think are not only lovely, but they're just necessary books for us to be reading.
They're important books, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the focus of Ice Cube Press is on writing from the Midwest, about the Midwest, about life in the Midwest. So I think that's a unique focus.
It is. And it's in the tradition of another fine press that I really revere is Milkweed Press, which started out sort of a similar way, focusing more on Minnesota writers. And now Milkweed has really just become one of the flagship presses around the country. And Ice Cube, I knew about Ice Cube before I moved to Iowa as potentially a place where I would be interested in publishing some of my books because of that focus on the Midwest. I mean, the Midwest, we don't often like to brag about it, but we have a good amount of really wonderful writers, and to have a press that seeks to bring out established and emerging voices in that region, I think is just one of the great gifts that Iowa has really bestowed on the world. And this anthology, Fracture, I think it stays in line with that mission about writers from the Midwest and writing about the Midwest, yet it also has a national focus. I mean, Steve really took a risk, I think, on some level in accepting this book because it seeks to highlight that the issue of hydraulic fracking is a nationwide issue. It's not just in, you know, four states where we know fracking is happening. It also impacts Minnesota with pipelines and the shipment of oil, you know, that goes around the country, and Iowa, and I mean, really all around the country, every state is impacted by fracking. And I'm happy to report a week after the book hit bookstores, we have already entered we've already gone to press for a second time. You know, we're in a second printing already.
That's amazing.
So it seems like this book is really resonating with people around the country.
Well, I've got to admit, when I sort of put off picking up and actually reading the book after I got it, you know, because fracking, you know, that's going to be so dull is what I thought. It's not dull at all.
No, it's not.
You know, I thought, oh, that's such a dry subject. Well, guess what? It is not.
It's because it impacts every single person on the planet. And
these stories are just, even if I didn't care about fracking, which I do, but even if I didn't, I think I'd be drawn into these stories.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. That's the best compliment an editor can receive. I mean, I think part of, you know, I get asked the question a lot, why literature? You know, why literature on a topic like fracking? We don't think of, you know, it's like water and oil. We don't think of these things mixing. But I think right there, that's exactly why we need to be trying to mix these two, because so much of our lives are dictated by these dings and pings and rings, and you get very quick journalistic pieces, or you might catch a snippet of something on the news. But literature, and really good literature, stays with you.
Right.
It allows, you know, I mean, there have been recent stories about people who read fiction are more compassionate, more open-minded people. And I think that's part of it. We really need stories to allow us to see into someone else's perspective, to say, this is my truth. This is what I'm seeing. Look at what's happening here. And to get poems, you know, poems that talk about pump jacks and about digging through 400 million years worth of Earth's history. You know, and right now in Iowa, I think the great question is, can a poem stop a pipeline? I think that's sort of the radicalness that we turn to literature for. I mean, think about the first time a person read To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, or 1984. I mean, these are books when I was a young reader. They just sort of bowled me over with their power. And I think once we can get people to inhabit a story, it opens up more questions and more potential insights as well.
I agree. And yeah, can a poem stop a pipeline? I don't understand. I thought the decreased price of oil would stop the pipeline.
And that's what a lot, because I've been traveling around the country, and doing different interviews, many people will say, well, we don't really need to worry about fracking because the low price will drive it out of business, you know. But what we're seeing is the price of oil is climbing
again.
You know, a few weeks ago, a barrel of oil, quite honestly, cost less than a bucket of KFC chicken.
Oh.
And I'm speaking to you right now from North Dakota, where I just went on a five-city book tour with some wonderful writers from around the country, and we went through the Bakken oil boom, and it is busting right now. That man camps are being dissembled. Those buildings are being shipped elsewhere. The busy part is really only Williston, North Dakota right now, sort of the epicenter. But as these prices climb, I start to wonder, will these companies be hurrying back into the region? You know, Halliburton laid off 7,000 workers last summer in this part of the world, and those people left. You know, I mean, they're not sticking around. They're looking for jobs elsewhere. But as oil prices climb back up, or if they continue to climb back up, what will we be facing? I mean, even with those low oil prices, you might have seen Florida just recently banned fracking, but they were considering opening up Florida, particularly near the Everglades, for fracking. David Cameron, the prime minister over in the United Kingdom, says he wants to frack the entire country. I think partly it's just because we have an industry that really has a noose around how we live our lives, and our lives are so intertwined with the use of oil that the big oil corporations, are somehow still able to find ways to do this practice, and at least, though they might be going into debt on some level for this practice right now, the idea is that oil prices will climb back up, and that will be worth what's happening right now.
Well, it seems like part of the reason oil prices fell was because of the increased supply because of fracking. So if the fracking fields close down as the prices fall, the supply will be less. That pushes prices back up. The fracking fields open again, and the same thing will happen all over again. So you'll just have boom and bust, boom and bust.
Well, and this is sort of the history of, you know, the interior West and the American West, boom and bust cycles. You know, Wallace Stegner wrote about this so beautifully, about boomers and stickers. The main reason these oil prices fell so much was that Saudi Arabia had flooded the market, because the Middle East is basically a sponge. You know, you step on the soil over there, and oil will come squirting up. You know, it's relatively easy to extract, compared to fracking is such an expensive process and such a labor-intensive process. You're busting through layers of rock and soil and things like this. But in Saudi Arabia, it's much easier to be done, and they've been doing it, you know, really comprehensively for a lot longer than we have in this country. So they're able to sell their oil for a much lower rate and control the market in that way, in the hopes to sort of drive down the profit of American and Canadian oil-based companies. But, you know, OPEC has sort of been stepping in, and so if those prices continue to rise, it seems that we could get those fracking operations up again. But at this time, we're also in this great transition of knowing we need to get off of this way of living. We need to be getting off of oil and coal, because we know climate change is real and we are causing it, and it's been happening and is happening. And so I'm hoping that's what an anthology like this can move us towards, to see different perspectives on what this looks like on the ground. You know, for a long time we've negated and ignored the great injustice of depending on oil in places like Nigeria and what the quality of life looks like there. And now we're seeing it in this country. You know, this is what oil development looks like. It means oil spills in the Missouri River. It means ruined cropland. It means flares flying in western North Dakota. stories, it might rile a few people up to say, hey, we need to shift how we do this.
And of course, the other disadvantage of the falling of lower prices was that it also makes solar and other alternative energy less price competitive.
Right, right, exactly, exactly. So I'm hoping there actually might be a window right now that we're facing that we can be developing alternative technologies quickly and efficiently to say, this is a stable way of consuming our energy. I mean, right now, later this year, the country's first completely solar-powered hotel will open. People might think, oh my goodness, that's going to be in Florida or the desert Southwest. Well, it's actually going to be in Oberlin, Ohio, about an hour and a half from Cleveland, which Oberlin, Ohio doesn't get even as much sunshine as Iowa does.
Wow.
If a completely solar-powered hotel is brought into existence in a state like Ohio, that really sort of quiets the arguments of, well, we could never do that here. You know what I mean?
It's incredible. And, you know, I really can't understand why anyone would spend the hundreds of millions of dollars required to build a pipeline now when, under any circumstances, that has to be a finite demand for oil as these other alternatives come on board. Why not put the money into the future instead of the past?
Well, and what we're seeing right now is that the total cost for this pipeline, at least what the Des Moines Register is reporting, is well over $1 billion. So it's over a thousand miles of pipeline. And now something that's important to be aware of, too, this Energy Transfer Partners that will be building this pipeline, this is their first pipeline that they've ever built. Massive. It's about 30 inches in diameter. It also means that Energy Transfer Partners, which is an LLC, has about $250,000 is what the company is valued at for insurance reasons. And I can tell you the number of oil and chemical spills in western North Dakota. When these happen, they are several million dollars. I mean, the largest on-land oil spill in the country happened in North Dakota, 865,000 gallons, and we're still cleaning it up 2 years later. The estimated cost of that oil spill, one oil spill, is $50 million. So the question becomes, if the company is insured for only $250,000, what happens when that pipeline breaks, and who is responsible for the cost of that break? You know, there are other factors in here. You know, Iowa's wonderful cropland, topsoil being ruined. What happens when that oil spills into waterways? What are the evacuation plans for cities living downstream? You're right, too. I mean, not that if oil were $200 a barrel, that would justify the construction of this type of pipeline. But we know that our continued dependence on this product draws into question the very habitability of the planet. Right now, we're going to see in the next month or two to see if the courts will rule that children have the right to sue the government for not acting quicker on climate change. If you have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but those very three tenets are drawn into question because of climate change, that's going to get very interesting, I think, for people right now. But the pipeline in Iowa, there are several hundred farms where eminent domain would have to be used. About 30% of the farmers along the route have held out and not signed over their easements because, you know, under the Bush administration, the Natural Gas Act created what's called the Halliburton loophole, meaning there's a public necessity and convenience clause. Well, oil and gas, of course, are public conveniences and necessities because we've built an entire society that's dependent upon these. So we can declare that and take farmers' land.
Except that oil's not even going to Iowa.
Right. No, it's connecting to an existing pipeline in Patoka, Illinois, and then it will ship down to the Gulf of Mexico. And part of what the fear is for people who might not have been following this, earlier last year, an oil company applied for a $600 million pipeline that would extend from the Bakken of western North Dakota, the Bakken Shale Play, and cross the border into Canada. Well, you can imagine how easy it would be to connect these two pipelines and then create a pipeline in Canada that goes to the tar sands.
Mm.
Part of the question we need to think about, is this actually a well-played chess game? And this is really the Keystone Pipeline that we're facing. When the Bakken oil no longer is profitable, but we're trying to get the tar sands, will tar sands oil start flowing through Iowa? These are utmost important questions, especially as it's faced right now that construction on the pipeline in Iowa would begin this year.
Oh, my gosh.
I just drove through Richardson, North Dakota, over near Dickinson yesterday, and I saw the very pipeline that will be certain legs of this pipeline. Thousands of pieces of 30-inch diameter pipeline sitting in a farmer's field. You know, right now, that part of the Iowa pipeline is assembled near Grinnell. What does this mean, and why have we allowed three people to be able to make this decision to say this is a good thing for Iowa? You know,
that's horrendous.
An atrocity.
It yeah. is an atrocity. Oh,
and I think
gosh.
That's where literature slips in sideways. I think it unhinges our brains. It gets us open to new perspectives. And it can create a type of anger and passion and movement in people to actually see other perspectives and to say, this is not the future we want. We do not want our watersheds compromised. What are the trade-offs we're willing to make? Iowa already faces high nitrate runoff.
Oh, yeah.
When oil mixes with that.
Well, this book should certainly wake people up if they would just pick it up and read it.
So, And the book we're talking about is Fracture, Essays, Poems, and Stories on Fracking in America. And our guest today is Taylor Brorby, who is the editor of that book. Taylor, why don't you read some selections from Fracture for us?
That sounds wonderful. How about let's start with a 318-word little essay, and this will sort of get us thinking about how this whole process begins, how people sign over their land and things like this. So this is called Seduction. Is by a wonderful Vermont-based writer named Mary Heather Noble. Seduction. It's a bit like adolescence, all this newfound attention that you think you understand, and the young man sitting on your mother's flowered couch is polite and respectful in a way that she'd sworn had gone extinct, talking about your future and security and the wealth of opportunities to come. And though you barely even know him, you can't help but feel a little taken with his outsider accent, his pressed polo shirt with the company logo over his heart, the way he folds his long fingers around your mother's chipped coffee mug as the steam from the brew rises and dances around his lips, which keep moving and assuring you that it will be safe. And think of the potential of this place. He uses noble words like exploration and independence and speaks of recovery in a way that means returning to normal or a healthy state of being, as if the way that you've been living here is neither of these things. He speaks of recovery as in returning something to its rightful owner, which is you and your family. Of course you want what's yours. you'll remember those moving lips when the trucks come rumbling in hour after hour, again and again, and the midnight light from the drill pad trespasses through your drawn bedroom curtains, the clanging and pounding invading the silence of your room. You'll remember those promises as you try to ignore the chemical veil and swallow the anxiety of what could be seeping into your well. Of course you want what's yours, but you won't know what they're taking when you unlock the gate and let them in, forcing and drilling, injecting God knows what into God knows where, and you'll think you're doing this for your future, think you're doing this out of love. But what do you know of love except for your mother's palm olive hands and the dance of the willows before a storm? A clean glass of water, the crescendo of cicada in the afternoon, the smell of wildflower dew. You'll be fooled by the softness of what they promise in the beginning, the finesse, but shocked by the unexpected violence of a frack. Is a persistent sting to innocence lost, a trace of diesel in the air.
Yeah, well, I think, a pretty accurate scenario of what happens, isn't it?
It's this way of being brought into a process that you're so easily told is everything's under control.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing bad will happen. We're actually helping you out. Your life has been so difficult in this part of the world. And just think, with a few pump jacks, we'll get you a few thousand more dollars a month into your pocketbook, and all will be well.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems so very rare that all is well. You know, right now there have been over 10,000 chemical and salt water and oil spills that have happened in western North Dakota, all of which empty into watersheds that flow into the Missouri River watershed. So that doesn't just impact western North Dakota. That impacts all the states downstream and flows on into the Gulf.
That's right.
I think that's part of the conversation we're not having. These faraway places in flyover country are so connected to so very many of us. And how do we start recognizing that with small decisions like that, with signing over easements, with letting large corporations manipulate us, it draws into question the very things we love, the land, the air, the water, the animals that we share our homes with.
Do you want to read some more?
I would love to. I would love to. Let's get some poetry. Mm-hmm. I think poetry is always a wonderful way to get us thinking in new ways. This is by Stephanie Schultz, who's mm-hmm. a young poet. She's in her late 20s, lives up in Minneapolis. It's a three-part poem. It's called Earth Elegy.
It's a good one.
One. Yep, Earth Elegy by Stephanie Schultz. One. Breathe in, breathe out. Push aside the menthol and mercury and smell the sweetness of benzene in the air. Let it relax you and grab a glass of water from the tap. Don't be afraid of the sparks. Think of them as cheerleaders encouraging you to frack today. Rinse off your dirt and troubles in a shower of acid and formaldehyde. Preserve this moment of time. Soon it will all be over. Two, you're wondering where all the water is going. That daily shower in California, sucking the last drops from dried up earth. It's not that. It's the millions of gallons you use to help shake the soil. Poor earth already trembled from shifting plates and trembles now from chemicals pushed deep down. Her only defense is to spit new ones back out in an explosive fit of toxic rage. Three, what water do we have left? Just the kind that lights on fire and whose scent can make us pass out. the kind that is no longer H2O. It burns our brains and lungs and changes who we are. It gets us thinking about wants and needs, the here and now and not the future. It alters our senses and rids us of any we had before. We start to think this fracking is okay.
Yeah, that's the problem.
And that, I mean, I think that's just in a wonderful conversation with that first piece of how we might say, yes, I want what's always been mine, this oil, this natural gas sitting below me. And then that poem just really explicitly gets at what are risks we face because of this? What are we not talking about? You know, what type of cancer clusters might be forming that we don't even know about, and the long-term impacts from exposures to benzene, which comes up in that poem. It's a known cancer-causing agent. It's in Bakken oil. Last January, a year ago in January, a pipeline burst under the Yellowstone River with Bakken oil and spilled about 40,000 gallons into the town of Glendive, Montana's drinking water. 6,000 people live there. And for a week, they couldn't drink or use their water. And as much as a month later, fish 100 miles downstream near where the Yellowstone meets the Missouri River were caught and had benzene in their muscle tissue. And so that's part of the conversation we're not really having yet in Iowa. What happens when that pipeline breaks and water flows into the Des Moines watershed, or when it bursts, you know, right by the Mississippi River? What happens to the ability to drink water, to use it for irrigation? What plans do we have in place to help people respond quickly? And I think we're seeing that in Flint, Michigan, of broken promises, of people that don't always have our best interests in place. And so I'm hoping a poem or an essay like I just read helps us ask better questions.
Well, also, it's a good way to, like, these stories are a good way to convey the facts, the information, because I, you know, was peripherally aware of fracking. I knew that I didn't like it, but I didn't realize, I didn't know
the
about
dangers.
All these injection wells where they put the wastewater. I didn't know that these earthquakes in Oklahoma have been linked to it. You know, things like that. You know, you sort of hear it in bits and pieces, but some of these stories really are bringing it.
You know, we like to think that we like to think the people in charge have our best interests at heart. You know, but
it's because it's their best interest too.
I know, but they don't seem to have.
Right. And the hard thing, you know, I mean, like in mid-February up in Calgary, there was a 4.8 size earthquake. 4.8, for those of us in Iowa who don't, you know, experience earthquakes, it's enough to rattle your windows. And it was directly linked to fracking, to this reinjection. And Catherine Miles, who I just spent a few days traveling around North Dakota with, is working on a book about seismic activity and induced seismic activity, like from practices like fracking and other things we do. And there are fault lines in Oklahoma, which have been reawoken, have been woken up due to this process, that now they're active because of the processes we've been doing down there. But there are fault lines in Oklahoma that extend all the way up into Saskatchewan. And Catherine's research with scientists around the country, many of which won't publicly go on record, show that if the right conditions are met, and one of these fault lines is activated, the entire middle of the country from Oklahoma up into Saskatchewan will not only be devastated, but the amount of survivors that we can count will be just a few dozen. because our structures in the Middle West are not designed for earthquakes.
No.
And we're starting to see Oklahoma is having three times as many earthquakes as California. And North Dakota, Oklahoma does not sit on those major fault lines the way of California. And it brings into question ethics and morals. And I think that's what literature also can help us start thinking about.
There is a fault line in Missouri, too, because yes. we had an earthquake here and one time. And
yeah, there have been a couple, but yeah. They're just, you know, tiny.
Yeah, things, tiny compared. But, you know, I'm sitting in my friend's house and the pan on the stove is vibrating and we're going, what is going on?
How long has fracking been practiced?
So fracking has been around for quite a while. It was developed more so in the 1940s is when it really started happening. But that was more for conventional drilling, meaning we would just go straight down, like pushing a needle into a pin cushion. What we're really talking about right now is what's called horizontal drilling. Around 2004, an engineer developed what's called a whipstock. And a whipstock, over several thousand feet, bends pipe slowly but surely horizontally.
Mm.
So that what it means, in places like North Dakota, where we know there's a lot of oil, but drilling straight down, we wouldn't be able to access much of it. It means you get to hit, it's sort of like an Oreo layer. You're drilling through and you bend the pipe so it can hit that level of cream horizontally and shoot up to 2 miles horizontally to access that level of product, of oil. So fracking itself has been around for a while, but horizontal drilling has really been around for just more than a decade.
And is that what makes it more harmful, the horizontal aspect, or is it always harmful, it's just they're doing a lot more of it now?
I think it has changed the game in terms of how we're able to access more oil rather than looking for large stores and pockets where we can just sort of suck it up like a vacuum. It means we can access that level of earth, which means more wells.
Okay.
You know, have been developed. You know, I mean.
Okay. So the process itself isn't necessarily any worse than it was. It's just that we're doing a whole lot more of it because more is accessible.
Okay. And we've accelerated that process. So it means because we've been doing so much of it and so quickly when oil prices were high, it also means that there were a higher amount of incidents and accidents and things like this because the idea was to access that product as quickly as possible to get it out. Because North Dakota wells are not as their longevity is not as much as Saudi Arabian wells.
Okay.
Wells in the Middle East fall by about 5% efficiency each year, where North Dakota's within the first year will fall by about 15% and then drop by another 50%. So wells need to be continually being accessed in order to get the amount of oil that we're hoping to get.
Well, Taylor, before we run out of time, let's have one more poem.
Yes, yes. Now, this is by Alison Hawthorne Deming, who's the great-granddaughter of Nathaniel Hawthorne.
She
teaches at the University of Arizona down in Tucson. And this poem, for those of us who've been following the news, we know Mr. Kelly, one of the twins, who's an astronaut, just came back after spending a year in space. So this will get at that idea about what an astronaut might see in space. It's called Homeland Security by Alison Hawthorne Deming. What is a day to the astronaut floating 200 miles above Earth, the space station whirling 15 times a day around the globe's circumference while he drifts weightless as if unmoving, sipping meals from a plastic pouch? Is that how it works, keeping everything contained against the drift? His twin is down there donating biometrics to the database. What is a year to them, to their bones and hearts and brains? That's what the instruments want to know, or what we've taught them to want. Did I mention that the space twin, too, is donating his stats? he'll pay the higher price for his unearthly habitation. Bodies need gravity or some system that simulates the magnetic pole of mantle and core. He can see home from a small window in space, the planet from out there, sublime, a blue and white ball so tender it might be made of glass just forming at the tip of the glass blower's rod. The Earth twin watched his brother lift off from the cosmodrome, 0 to 17,000 in 12 minutes. It feels like the hand of God has come down and grabbed you by the collar and ripped you off the planet. You're either going to float in space or you're going to be dead. Mm-hmm. What is Earth to the astronaut? It is the exception to emptiness. Sure, other planets lie further out in the black concealment of space. Best, perhaps, that we do not know their voraciousness and need. Ours, we know, is troubled by privileged greed, yet still in the heyday of its experiment with life. What is an atmosphere, and how did Earth get one? Thanks. Thanks, cyanobacteria, for your evolutionary gift, the great oxygenation event that made us possible. I'm writing this to find my way into the fray over fracking, wild card as it seems now that I've gone so far out into space. But no one wants to hear again about flaming water faucets, exploited towns and farms, heartland riddled with quakes, water poisoned and stuck back in the ground to find its way home. Space might be the only way to see what kind of sky we need and how the great carbonation event might be flipping the way Earth does or doesn't do life. We say blue marble. We say Mother Earth. We say home. The astronaut says beautiful. Earth from space says keep me. Homeland security means leave it in the ground. Lock it up with soldiers standing guard. Cover it with grassland and trees.
Amen to that.
Oh, boy.
That was Taylor Broerby reading from Fracture, Essays, Poems, and Stories on Fracking in America. Highly recommend it. It is
Everybody
enjoyable
read it.
To read despite the harshness of the subject. And we're out of time, so thank you so much for being with us, Taylor.
Thank you so much for having me. This has just been a gift.
It's a gift for us too.
Yes, you are a gift, no doubt.
Yeah. Mom, do you have some final words for us
today?
Yeah,
you know, of course, fracking is legal, right? Just because something is legal does not mean it's right. So we have to support and do the right thing. Thank you.
And thank you for joining us on Writers' Voices. Stay tuned now for Planet Earthwild, and see you next week on Writers' Voices. Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.